welcome you to VOA Asia Weekend. On today's Look Back at the Week, you'll hear what the United States president plans to do when he meets with Kim Jong-un.
We're going to be very different. We're going to negotiate in a different way than has been done before.
And the U.S. delegation travels to China for possibly contentious trade talks on the Chinese financial system.
It's a system that has, in all honesty, probably worked pretty well for the Chinese. And it has not worked well for us.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Those stories and more on VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said during an expected nuclear summit over the next few weeks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, President Donald Trump will insist on deeds and actions by Pyongyang, not words and promises.
This administration has its eyes wide open. We know the history. We know the risks. We're going to be very different. We're going to negotiate in a different way than has been done before. We're going to require those steps. We use the word irreversible with great intention. We're going to require those steps that demonstrate that denuclearization is going to be achieved. We're not going to take promises. We're not going to take words. We're going to look for actions and deeds. And until such time, the president has made incredibly clear, we will keep the pressure campaign in place until we achieve that. That's different. And so in each case, both countries will have to do more than words. We'll have to actually deliver an outcome that is the one that Kim Jong-un and I had the chance to talk about at the direction of the president.
Helping to set the stage for the Trump-Kim summit was another historic summit, this one between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, which ended with a joint commitment toward denuclearization and peace in the Korean Peninsula. VOA's Jesusaman Oni reported.
Following a rapid thaw in relations, the leaders of North and South Korea hailed what they call a new era of peace. In Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump praised the North Korean leader's latest diplomatic overture.
I don't think he's playing, and you know, it's never gone like this. It's never gone this far.
On Friday, Kim became the first North Korean leader to step across the border into South Korea. During the historic summit with President Moon Jae-in, the two leaders agreed to work towards removing all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula, but neither side provided details or specific commitments. Words are not enough, warns East Asia expert Dennis Wilder.
So far, all we have are promises. We don't have any real concrete steps that the North has taken that we can see, other than the fact that he has postponed any missile or nuclear tests for several months.
North Korea's nuclear weapons have been a major sticking point in relations with the United States. Washington employed a campaign of maximum pressure, which includes hefty sanctions and frequent threats of military force, to persuade the North to abandon its nuclear program. Now, weeks ahead of a possible face-to-face meeting with Kim, President Trump says he feels a personal responsibility to make the world safer.
It's certainly something that I hope I can do for the world. This is beyond the United States. This is a world problem, and it's something that I hope I'm able to do for the world.
North Korea has made similar commitments in the past, and yet, despite the absence of results, retired four-star general Jack Keane says it's worth a try.
For the sake of the peninsula, for the sake of the region, and for the sake of the world, it's worth doing. So we'll see. No one knows for sure. But the opportunity that we have, we've never had this opportunity before.
Trump insists the maximum pressure campaign will continue until the North agrees to halt its nuclear weapons program. Jesus Amelny, VOA News, Washington.
Despite recent tensions over North Korea's nuclear and missile tests, life is actually quite normal for American military families living at Camp Humphreys in South Korea, the largest overseas U.S. Army installation in the world. VOA's Brian Patton reported from Camp Humphreys that the increased threat of military conflict with North Korea has not altered the family-friendly environment on this growing base, located just 100 kilometers from the heavily fortified inter-Korean border.
Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Puskus tries to come to most of his daughter's high school soccer games at Camp Humphreys. In fact, his family's lifestyle at this sprawling American military base is similar to one they would lead back home.
We go to church on Sundays. We see, you know, all our friends there. You know, we're on the soccer field most in the afternoons or just going for a bike ride. I mean, the same thing we do if we were back in the States.
Camp Humphreys is the size of a small city and is continuing to grow to accommodate over 40,000 people as the U.S. military in Korea moves to close older bases in congested Seoul and other regions of the country. There are modern apartments for soldiers and their families, schools, American shopping centers, and fast food restaurants to help bring some of the comforts of home to military life in Korea.
I've been around the Army for part of the last 40 years as a soldier and now as a civilian. And this is as normal as any Army post I've been on. In fact, it's probably the nicest one I've been on because everything's new.
The annual U.S.-South Korean military exercises underway are just part of the routine of military life here. Like many U.S. soldiers in Korea, Lieutenant Colonel Puskas tries not to overreact to reports that war is imminent over the North's nuclear and missile tests or that peace is at hand with the upcoming nuclear summits.
I mean, obviously, we're sensitive to what is going on. Do we worry about it? I mean, we think about it.
Instead, Puskas, like many in Camp Humphreys, works to balance family responsibilities with maintaining military readiness. Brian Patton, VOA News, Camp Humphreys.
As we continue on VOA Asia Weekend, preserving Tibetan culture. As developments in North Korea continue to develop rapidly, we invite you to read more on our stories each day by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. The U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan is dropping bombs at a record pace, nearly 17 years into a war that even U.S. military leaders concede is a stalemate. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reported, it is not clear the bombs are helping end the deadlock.
A deadly start to 2018 in Afghanistan. During the first 3 months of the year, coalition planes dropped more bombs than in that same period in any of the past 15 years. It's the latest evidence the war is significantly intensifying since President Donald Trump announced a new military strategy in August. But for nearly 17 years, bombs have been unable to end the conflict. And more bombs now are unlikely to help, says Thomas Johnson, author of Taliban Narratives.
So I think that it's an act of desperation by the U.S. You know, they cannot kill enough Taliban through the air to be able to have any significant impact on the war.
2018 is likely to get even more violent as fighting picks up during the warmer months. On Sunday, nearly 60 people were killed when the Islamic State attacked an election registration center in Kabul. The violence comes as Afghan President Ashraf Ghani calls on the Taliban to join the political arena and participate in the upcoming election. That effort has been praised by analysts such as Johnson, who say there is no military solution to the war.
I don't care if you double the amount of air sorties that you're flying right now. We will never win this war militarily. The only solution to this war is political.
But U.S. military officials say the bombing campaign is part of a larger strategy that leads to a negotiated settlement, no matter how long that may take. According to the latest U.S. military estimate, the Afghan government controls just over half the country's districts, with insurgents controlling or contesting the rest. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Pollution of the ocean is a global issue, and many countries are taking measures to prevent it. But in the case of Pakistan, no strategy has been developed to deal with pollution, which is having a negative impact on life up and down that country's coast. Cheyenne Salim from VOA's Urdu service visited the port city of Karachi, Pakistan's most populous city, as Aman Azar narrates.
6,000 industrial complexes in Karachi have dumped toxic waste into the ocean, according to a committee of Pakistan's Senate. Leaking oil from ships, tons of plastic materials, polluted waters from the rivers, and sewage are also fouling the waters. And people notice.
We came to Karachi from Multan and saw so much pollution. When we waded through the water, We felt something is biting our skin. The water has become so toxic.
Karachi dumps tens of thousands of metric tons of garbage into the sea every day.
Karachi ka rozana 500 million gallon.
37,000 metric tons of garbage of the city is being dumped into the sea, making it polluted. Once seawater in Karachi was described as blue water. Children used to play games at that time. They would throw coins into the sea and then dive down and retrieve them. Now, due to pollution, the blue water has turned into black water.
It is estimated that close to 4 million people are employed directly or indirectly by Pakistan's fishing industry. Ocean pollution has hit them hard.
We take the nets. We get more of the waste than fish. We will feed the children only when we catch them. We have no livelihood now.
We used to fish and enjoy eating our catch. Now we do not have the same enjoyment. Fish that we net look fragile, and dead fish is coming too.
Cleaning up Pakistan's coastal waters and its 1,050 kilometers of beaches will take public action.
Every citizen is saying that pollution is increasing. Why don't we do something ourselves? When we visit the beaches, we should collect our own trash and bring it back and put it in the trash cans. The way we keep our homes, streets, and neighborhood clean, if we keep our ocean clean, then the pollution will be reduced to some extent.
Experts say that permission for setting up an industrial plant is conditional upon building a treatment facility as well. But they note that the law is rarely enforced. For Shayan Salim in Karachi, Aman Azhar, VOA News.
Thank you for being and staying with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The Trump administration has abandoned plans to appoint a new ambassador to Australia, 18 months after the last U.S. envoy finished his assignment. Many in Australia see the move as a snub, although the government in Canberra says it is not offended. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The last permanent U.S. ambassador to Canberra was John Berry, who left the post in 2016. The position is seen as a desirable appointment, given Canberra's leafy surrounds and the relative calm of Australian politics. But the posting has been vacant for 18 months. The Trump administration had planned to nominate Admiral Harry Harris from the U.S. Pacific Command as the next United States ambassador to Australia. That decision has been reversed, and Admiral Harris, a high-ranking Japanese-American naval officer, will instead become Washington's envoy in South Korea. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said he was disappointed his good friend wouldn't be taking up a senior diplomatic role in Canberra, but that he understood the decision given the Admiral's expertise and experience. But there is disquiet in other quarters. Former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says President Trump is in danger of taking Australia, a long-standing ally, for granted.
I think the bottom line is the administration's decided that South Korea demonstrably is strategically more important, given what's happening with the inter-Korean summit. You can understand that reasoning. But for Australia, I think it does indicate, at least from the view of the Trump administration, we are seen as something as a second-rate ally. President Trump is not a popular figure within Australia for a whole range of reasons on the right and the left of politics. But the bottom line is all Australians expect any administration in the United States to take our alliance seriously.
Australia signed a formal security treaty with the United States in the early 1950s. The agreement has underpinned Australia's national security ever since. While it has close trading ties with China and a historic relationship with its former colonial masters in Britain, Australia considers its alliance with the United States to be its most important. Every year since 2012, US Marines have been routinely stationed in Australia's Northern Territory. The next contingent, almost 2,000 strong, is due to arrive in Darwin next month. Announced in 2011, the so-called Force Posture Agreement between Canberra and Washington is designed to enhance military cooperation. The English-speaking nations have fought on the same side in various conflicts for a century, including Vietnam and Iraq. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tibetan exiles marking the 60th year of the Dalai Lama's arrival in India after fleeing his homeland say they have successfully safeguarded Tibetan culture and preserved Tibetan identity, which Tibetan leaders warn is threatened by Chinese rule in their homeland. Some 70 schools run by the Tibetan Exile Administration in India, which is home to the largest Tibetan refugee community in the world, are at the heart of those efforts. Anjana Pasricha recently visited a Tibetan school in the Indian capital.
These songs and nursery rhymes being chanted by children in a school in New Delhi are all in Tibetan. And they are being taught by teachers dressed in the traditional Tibetan dress, the chuba. Migmar Sering, principal at the TCV Day School, Samailing, says this helps the more than 100 students learn about the homeland they have never seen.
They advise the Tibetan situation not related with politics, just we have a big, we have a beautiful country. Example, we have a beautiful country, we have a good language, we have a good identity, we have a good religion.
At schools like this run by the Tibetan Exile Administration in India, children learn the Tibetan script and read storybooks translated into the language. Young girls play traditional musical instruments. Teacher Sonam Chedan says until grade 3, all subjects are taught in their native language.
You know, in Tibet, now Tibetan language, the Chinese, they are suppressing all the, even in the class, they are not allowed to talk in Tibetan, only the Chinese language. So to preserve our language here in exile, we, especially in the school, we try to, everything we try to convert in Tibetan only.
Some fear these efforts to safeguard their culture could face a challenge as younger Tibetans look for opportunities outside India. Others say the traditions they assimilated growing up in Tibetan settlements and schools remain strongly with them even overseas, like Tenzin Dikong, who migrated to Australia in 2014.
Through the elder stories and through our teachers, when we learn Tibetan subjects, we learn a lot of histories and all the stuff, so I do really feel very connected with Tibetan cultures and how Tibet looks like, and I do have some imagination how Tibet looks like surrounded by all mountain tree, all the monastery.
Nurturing their roots keeps alive the dream of someday carrying back their traditions to their homeland.
We have a truth. One day we go back to Tibet. I just believe that.
A third generation of Tibetan refugees is now growing up in India, home to the largest Tibetan exile community in the world. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The path to sharper vision has gone from glasses to contact lenses to laser correction, and now to eye drops. Faith Lapidus had details of the latest development.
For the more than 200 million people around the world who don't have 20/20 vision, a pair of glasses can bring the world into focus. Contact lenses put the corrective lens right on the eye. And laser eye surgery actually changes the shape of the cornea, the protective layer that rests above the eye's lens and the iris. Israeli researchers say their nano eye drops could provide a simple alternative to all of those.
The idea is really to change, find a way to modify the trajectory of light with eye drops just by not changing the shape as we are doing with glasses, contact lens or laser refractive surgery, but by modifying the refractive index of the cornea. So we could just play with the light and change the trajectory in order to have all the light in focus.
The procedure is designed to be performed mostly at home with a smartphone app that measures the adjustments required for sharp vision.
As soon as you have the number you need to correct from home, then you will clip a small device. Inside this device, you will have a small laser source that can etch and put an optical pattern that he can draw really at the surface of the cornea and just to open the door to the nanoparticles.
The synthetic nanoparticle solution would fill the tiny etched pattern on the cornea so light is in focus when it hits the retina. Initial tests on fresh pig eyes analyzed refractive errors before and after adding nanodrops and found the drops corrected vision problems for several hours. The next phase of experiments will determine how long the nanodrops remain effective. They hope the procedure will be ready for use by the end of next year. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A cup of coffee is a good way for many to start the day, but it can also do far greater good. Manyang Kerr, a former Sudanese child refugee, one of the so-called lost boys and now a U.S. citizen, is passionate about helping refugees build a brighter future. And he does it with coffee. VOA's Jun So talked with the founder of a social enterprise, 734 Coffee. VOA's Carol Pearson narrates her report.
In this warehouse outside Washington, D.C., Manyang Kerr operates 734 Coffee. He launched the specialty coffee business last year to raise funds for refugees.
734 is the geographical coordination of refugee camp in Ethiopia, where 250,000 refugees live. I know the struggle those refugees face every day.
The camp in Ethiopia's Gambela region was Kerr's home for 13 years. At age 3, he became one of the lost boys, the name given to an estimated 20,000 children who were displaced and orphaned by the civil war in Sudan.
When I was 3 years old, my village was attacked, and then it was burned down by the northern part of the government. So we, the children, when our village was burned and we separated from our parents, we'd run to Ethiopia, and then we become refugees. Too many children had died along the way.
It was a 1,600-kilometer journey. And being a refugee, living in a camp, Kerr recalls, was terrifying.
You fear every day because you think you're going to die too. You see kids die from hunger because they don't have food. You see kids dying of cholera. You see kids dying of disease. You see kids just running away from refugee camp. They just wanted to go to a place to be home, and they die there.
At age 16, Kerr had an opportunity to come to the U.S., as an unaccompanied minor refugee. But he never forgot the people struggling to survive in the camps he left behind. He sells the coffee online, at events, and to coffee shops.
The customers love it. Whenever they find out about the project, about the mission, they connect right with it. The coffee tastes delicious, and so it's a win-win on both sides. You get to enjoy coffee at the same time, be part of a bigger project.
A cup of 734 coffee can buy, this cup can buy one fishing net, also can buy pens, can help with our scholarship system to send kids to school. So everything in 734 means you're helping refugees help themselves.
For producer Jun So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
China's top diplomat, Foreign Minister Wang Yi, traveled to North Korea this week following last week's historic inter-Korean summit and ahead of a proposed meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. Appearing on the ABC program this week, last Sunday, new U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who met with Mr. Kim 4 weeks ago, said the U.S. objective remains unchanged: complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization.
I had a mission to begin to lay the groundwork for President Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un. We wanted to make sure we understood that the North Koreans, Kim Jong-un, was prepared to talk about the things that matter most. To give us a basis to have that meeting between the president and the chairman. It was a productive one. We had a good conversation. We talked about serious matters. We had an extensive conversation on the hardest issues that face our two countries. I had a clear mission statement from President Trump. When I left there, Kim Jong-un understood the mission exactly as I've described it today. And he agreed that he was prepared to talk about that and to lay out a map that would help us achieve that objective. Only time will tell if we can get that done.
Pompeo also revealed that the matter of 3 jailed Americans in North Korea had been discussed, a matter White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said is at the top of the president's mind. Last Sunday, South Korea and the North were preparing to invite American and South Korean experts and journalists to watch the country shut its nuclear test site in May. Pyongyang was also promising to set its clocks forward 30 minutes to the same time as South Korea. Despite all that has happened, Tufts University assistant professor Sung-Yoon Lee told VOA's Victor Beatty so far, Kim Jong-un has only given away concessions he can afford to.
Releasing the U.S. detainees, changing so-called Pyongyang time to comport more with standard time in the region. North Korea has offered, Kim Jong-un has, to shut down its old nuclear testing site, probably because it doesn't need to conduct another underground test. They've shown the world that they can do a hydrogen bomb test last September.
What is the key to sincerity on the part of North Korea?
Kim Jong-un is stealing pages from his daddy's playbook. It's almost as if the Kim dictators have a split personality. They relentlessly go on a bluster barrage threatening war, and then all of a sudden, very dramatically, puts on an entirely different face, flashing smiles for the cameras. And that's what Kim Jong-il did when he hosted the South Korean president for the very first inter-Korean summit in 2000, when he sent a special envoy to the Clinton White House, when he visited Putin in 2001, received Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi in Pyongyang in 2002, and so on. And this is an elaborate process by which the funny-looking, cruel North Korean dictator effects a metamorphosis, moves from being little rocket man, cruel dictator, to a global statesman.
Your assessment of that inter-Korean summit?
I think we're looking for indicators of change in all the wrong places. Kim Jong-un is very good at theatrics. North Korea is very good at choreography, putting on the world's biggest spectacle, the Mass Games, featuring 100,000 performers and so on. So this is not unexpected at all. It's entirely predictable. Everyone says North Korea is so unpredictable. Well, I would say North Korea is approximately predictable. So the real indicators of change would be, you know, downsize that hyper-expanded military of over 1.1 million men, remove those tens of thousands of cannons, artillery trained on South Korea, dismantle the gulags, release political prisoners, grant the people some basic freedoms like freedom to receive and impart and access information and ideas and so on. But none of that is happening. All Kim Jong-un has provided so far is verbal palliative that he will change, that he will be amenable to nuclear negotiations, and he won't conduct any ballistic missile tests in the meantime. Whereas if a notorious international outlaw said, I won't commit any crimes in the meantime, and then is wined and dined by world leaders, I think we would find that strange.
South Korea's military Monday said it will soon pull back all high-decibel loudspeakers installed along the border with North Korea following last week's inter-Korean summit. The South earlier halted propaganda broadcast to the North. Optimism abounds in Seoul following the historic summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. VOA's Brian Patton reported from the South Korean capital with local reaction to the summit and expectations for the future.
From that historic step across the border, marking the first time a North Korean leader had ever entered South Korean territory, to the jovial moment when Kim Jong-un invited South Korean President Moon Jae-in to step back over the border into the north, to the animated conversation the two leaders had as they sat alone for 30 minutes, to the joint declaration proclaiming that a new era of peace has begun, the inter-Korean summit has left many in Seoul feeling hopeful about the future.
I was very thrilled while watching it. It was a time that gave me hope that unification may come very soon.
To many viewing the summit, the young North Korean leader also came across as more reasonable and open to change than the authoritarian figure who in the past had repeatedly threatened to launch nuclear strikes against his enemies.
He seemed to be very authoritative as a dictator, but he gave a positive impression that he is daring, smart, and bold.
At the summit, Kim agreed to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has unilaterally suspended nuclear and missile tests, and officials in Seoul said Pyongyang would invite international experts and journalists to witness the closing of the country's nuclear test site in May. Following the summit, President Moon's approval rating increased to over 70%. Many conservative voters who did not support the liberal president now give him credit for persistently pursuing diplomatic engagement.
Even after Moon Jae-in became president, as I was a conservative, I did not have favorable feeling of him. But he seems to be sincere and responsible with his words. That makes others trust him.
The joint denuclearization declaration, however, is just the beginning of the negotiation process. Next up, the meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and Kim that is expected to take place before July. While the Trump administration has been supportive of the progress made so far, it wants to see irreversible reductions in the North's nuclear program before agreeing to reduce economic sanctions. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A team of diplomats from the UN Security Council was to meet the de facto leader of Myanmar, also known as Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi, last Monday after visiting Muslim Rohingya refugees at the Kutupalan camp Sunday. They say they fled a crackdown by the Myanmar military they said included rape, murder, and arson. Among the delegation members was British diplomat Karen Pierce, who encountered the women and girls subjected to the alleged atrocities.
Enormous distress and sympathy for what those poor women and those poor children have been through and are still going through. And it's enormous horror that other human beings could put them through that. And I think it shows us the scale of the challenge as we try, as the Security Council, to find some way through that enables these poor people to go home. The sad thing is there's nothing we can do right today that will make their distress any less. But I think it gives everyone another reason to redouble their efforts in the Security Council.
Pierce said the Rohingya came from Myanmar, and the solution, she added, must lie in Myanmar. U.S. Deputy U.N. Ambassador Kelly Curry warned the suffering of nearly 700,000 refugees will worsen soon with the onset of monsoon rains. Monique Skidmore is a professor and deputy vice chancellor of the University of Tasmania in Australia. She told VOA the UN diplomats wanted to see for themselves if the allegations against the Myanmar security forces were overblown, given the strident rejection by the army of the refugees' claims.
And it's very clear that they have been, in their own words, overwhelmed by the trauma of what they've witnessed, by the graphic photographs they've been shown. And I think they've been very much energized to try and sort the situation if it's at all possible.
Skidmore says the refugees themselves know what the UN is able to do and have asked for specific actions.
Residents of the refugee camps are well aware. The UN Security Council does have the ability to refer the Myanmar government to the International Criminal Court, and that was one of the demands that they presented to the delegation. The other interesting demand was that they wanted the UN to supervise their repatriation. And this, I think, strengthens Aung San Suu Kyi's arm greatly, because here she has an opportunity to suggest to the military that if she can do something to make sure that they are not referred to the International Criminal Court, perhaps the best way forward is to allow the UN to re-enter Rakhine State. And in this way, she would have independent eyes over the ongoing situation there.
The UN team is also meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi, who Skidmore says is looking for a reset in relations with the world body.
In the last week, she has hinted that she wants a new relationship with the UN. And on Tuesday, after meeting Suu Kyi, they will go to Rakhine State. And that'll be the first time the UN has been allowed into Rakhine State since this occurred last August. So she is hoping that she will be able to have supervised faster process of repatriation, and that it will stop this incipient warfare that's been going on, a war of words between the UN and Aung San Suu Kyi and her party and her government. And this would allow a much better security for the Rohingya when they repatriate to Rakhine State.
2 weeks ago, Myanmar said it conducted its first repatriation, but Monique Skidmore said that process has not really begun, in part because of the demands of the refugees, including citizenship, a halt to the construction of refugee camps for those returning to Myanmar, and UN supervision of their return to their restored homes. Vietnam has sounded off twice against China over a long, festering maritime sovereignty dispute after months of silence. But analysts expect to see angry phrases like this one alternate more often with silent ones. The foreign ministry in Vietnam said on April 24th that China violated Vietnamese sovereignty by installing military jamming equipment in the disputed seas Paracel Islands. Carl Thayer, Southeast Asia's specialized emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia, says the equipment could disrupt Vietnamese flights and its own military activity. Thayer says Vietnam increasingly values economic ties with China and looks to political channels for solving disputes.
Internally, the leaders have to constantly weigh what's China's reaction going to be in particular circumstances. And if they're looking for something, they may not want to rock the boat and move more cautiously. So it's tactical, but it's that constant weighing up of we go too far or haven't we done enough? And looking at internal pressure.
Vietnam and China contest parts of the South China Sea. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and the Philippines also claim all or parts of the sea, which includes prime fisheries and fossil fuel reserves. While China claims about 90% of the sea, other countries rarely speak out. Analysts often look to Vietnam first for any outcry against Chinese military expansion in the seas Paracel and Spratly Island chains. But until a couple of weeks ago, Vietnam had withheld virulent criticism of China since condemning military exercises in August of 2017. Some scholars, like Eduardo Araral, says it wants a stronger economy and political relationship.
There's some balancing mechanism, so it's a hot and cold relationship. But I do not expect the Vietnamese government to go out of its way to criticize China because it's a very delicate situation.
Vietnam counts China as a source of tourism and raw material for manufacturing. We thank Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. What if refilling a prescription was as easy as withdrawing money from an ATM? A South African tech company wants to make that possible. Their innovation, the Pharmacy Dispensing Unit, is currently being tested in Johannesburg, and health experts say it could provide a strong boost for the fight against HIV/AIDS in South Africa and potentially the region. Zahir Kasim reported for VOA from Alexandra Township of Johannesburg.
Hilda Tlala is off to pick up her antiretroviral medication. She must do this every month. In the past, she could miss a whole day of work waiting at the clinic, but not today.
Before, when I was taking my medication to the clinic, I have to wake up 5 o'clock and come back again 5 o'clock. Now, I think now this new system is much more easier because now I can take my children to school and go and collect my medication. It's much more easier now.
This is the Pharmacy Dispensing Unit, or PDU. The machine was developed here in South Africa and is being piloted in Johannesburg townships in partnership with the local government. The PDU scans a patient's identification. A pharmacist pops up on screen for a quick check-in. All that's left to do is pick up the medicine refill from from the bin below. It takes about 3 minutes.
So here we provide chronic medication, and the majority of our chronic patients are HIV positive, so they take ARVs. That's close to 90% of the medication that we stock here.
Currently, 3,000 to 4,000 patients are seen a month in this facility, with this number expected to quadruple within the next couple of years.
South Africa has the world's largest HIV epidemic, accounting for 1 in 5 people living with the virus globally. But only about half of HIV patients in South Africa access ARV therapy. Dr. Mabulawa Mugabe of UNAIDS is optimistic about the PDU.
So for me, it's a game changer because one of our biggest challenges today in most countries in Africa is the fact that our facilities are congested. We need to find ways in which we can release the congestion, both in the interest of the patient themselves, but also in the interest of the health system themselves, so that we lessen the burden. In other words, patients who don't need to go in queue don't have to go in queue.
PDU centers are expected to open soon in 2 other townships. The company envisions one day installing PDUs in malls and other public spaces as well. Zahir Kassim for VOA News, Johannesburg.
We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Chinese state media Wednesday said President Xi Jinping's chief economic advisor, Liu He, will meet with the senior-level U.S. trade delegation. Talks were set for Thursday and Friday in Beijing over the trade imbalance between the two biggest economies and allegations of Chinese intellectual property theft. The Trump administration has proposed tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods and could go into effect in a matter of weeks. China has threatened retaliation. Before leaving Washington last Tuesday, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer discussed U.S. concerns about the prospect of a trade war with China during a public forum at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
It's not my objective to change the Chinese system. The Chinese have their own system. The president says this all the time, and it seems to work for them. That's fine. But I have to be in a position where the United States can deal with it, where the United States isn't the victim of it. It's a big, big challenge, all right? There's a very different system over there, and it's a system that has, in all honesty, probably worked pretty well for the Chinese. And it has not worked well for us, and it's worked for some U.S. companies that have managed to make money there and actually repatriate it. So it's complicated, and it affects almost every part of our economy. So it's a big, big job. You know, it would be good if we can manage this problem. I mean, the way I see the difference between our systems is we're going to spend the next years developing how we deal with each other over a period of time. And that's going to be a question of having issues that you have to work out and try to figure out a way that solves that issue, and then you move on to when you have the next issue, and then over a period of time, you end up knowing how to deal with it, how to kind of manage it between the two of you, and we're at an early stage of that. China's had extraordinary growth in the last few years, so the relationship has changed. So there's an awful lot to it, but hopefully we'll be in a position where at least this particular issue we can move beyond. But it's very, very difficult.
Lighthizer was joined by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and White House Economic Advisors Larry Kudlow and Peter Navarro. Gary Huffbauer, an economist with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, spoke with VOA about the U.S. objectives.
What they hope to extract from China are some concessions on two fronts. On one front, they want China to reduce tariffs or enlarge quotas on products of interest to the United States, and agricultural products are first and foremost in that, but autos would be a possibility, and there are other products as well. Secondly, they want China to stop requiring foreign companies, especially U.S. companies, to transfer technology as the price of admission to produce in China. I think that's a very difficult proposition. That's been a mainstay of Chinese policy for quite some time now. I will be pleasantly surprised if they make much progress on that agenda. Maybe getting some tariff reductions or quota enlargements, they might come away with a prize. But let me emphasize that the Chinese are very tough negotiators.
The high-profile nature of this shows the seriousness with which the U.S. is approaching this particular issue that could potentially lead to a trade war.
Not only because it's a very high-profile group, and if they come away empty-handed, you could say we're on the verge of a trade war. But the other thing that's happened in the last 10 days or 2 weeks is that the U.S. is kind of making peace on other fronts where we had trade disagreements. With NAFTA, they say they hope to have an agreement within a couple of weeks. And then steel and aluminum, they've postponed the deadline for eliminating waivers till June 1st. For countries other than China, the United States is trying to relax trade tensions. And that means that they want to focus most of the attention on China.
Steel and aluminum tariff exemptions have been extended just for 30 days for the European Union. They're saying that breeds market uncertainty. Does it? And can they get permanent exemptions?
The Europeans, yes, they're not happy about it, nor are other countries that have gotten the exemption just have another 30 days. But the price of steel in the United States as a result of this tariff policy has gone up quite significantly, about 20%. And that's a big rise in price. And those shippers from countries that don't pay tariffs, those steel firms, they're making more money. They're shipping as much steel as they did before, and they're getting 20% more on the price. So, you know, that's kind of a happy day for them. What they really want is a permanent exemption. And I think there's a good chance they will get a permanent exemption, but they'll be limited in terms of the quantity they can sell. So they'd like to sell a lot more at that 20% higher price. They won't be able to, but that's kind of the bargain that looks like emerging.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said if the U.S. trade delegation is sincere, both sides can have constructive trade talks. In a Wednesday editorial, the state-run China Daily said the time when China could be forced to open its door is long past, and Beijing is not opening it any wider to appease others. It said President Xi's recent call for greater market access for foreign companies, lowering tariffs and strengthening intellectual property protections is merely a new phase in China's development, and the benefits it provides others is an added bonus. Air pollution is killing millions of people around the world every year, with 9 out of 10 people breathing air containing high levels of pollutants. That is the conclusion from the World Health Organization's latest research on pollution, which uses data from 4,300 cities in 108 countries. As Henry Ridgewell reported, it is the poorest who are suffering most from the health effects of air pollution.
Mongolia's capital, Ulaanbaatar, is one of the most polluted cities on Earth. In winter, smoke from fires combines with fumes from factories and road traffic to create a toxic smog, which often gets trapped in the cold air. Air pollution levels can reach 100 times World Health Organization limits. Batbayar Munguntul is a mother of 3 young children living in the centre of the city. In the morning, when you open the window, she says, you smell the exhaust from cars and you don't smell any air. You are just smelling gas, and we are breathing that. The World Health Organization estimates that 7 million people die each year because of air pollution. Maria Nera is head of the WHO's Public Health Department.
We know that 4.2 million are due to exposure to outdoor air pollution, what we call ambient air pollution. So it's related to what we do at the urban level. While 3.8 million deaths are associated to the fact that many people around the world is still relying on very polluting fuels for cooking or heating or lighting in their houses at the household level.
fine particles in polluted air, such as sulfate, nitrates, and black carbon, can penetrate deep into the lungs and cardiovascular system, causing diseases including stroke and heart disease, lung cancer, and respiratory infections, including pneumonia. More than 90% of fatalities occurred in low- and middle-income countries, mainly in Asia and Africa, a fact WHO aggregate figures can obscure, says analyst William Avis of Britain's University of Birmingham via Skype.
When discussing air pollution, it's important to acknowledge its particular impact on, for example, the very young, the elderly, persons with pre-existing cardiac or respiratory conditions, those who live close to sources of air pollution, such as busy roads and polluting factories, and those who work in low-paid, poorly regulated jobs where occupational exposure may be higher.
Avis and university colleagues, in conjunction with African counterparts, are researching how rapid urbanisation in Addis Ababa, Kampala and Nairobi impacts air quality. By 2050, it is projected that two-thirds of the world's population will live in cities.
With the highest rates of urban growth expected in low- and middle-income countries, more specifically, it is in the poor informal settlements on the peri-urban periphery that growth is expected to be greatest. Rapidly expanding cities that are poorly planned, managed and governed can become centres of poverty, inequality and environmental degradation marked by worsening air quality.
The World Health Organization says there has been progress, with many cities collecting air pollution data for the first time and policy initiatives bearing fruit. They highlight Mexico City's commitment to ban diesel cars by 2025. In Mongolia, the government has begun funding air filtration systems for urban schools. Critics say that is just treating the symptoms, and authorities must do more to cut the sources of pollution. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia Weekend. South Korea Wednesday ruled out linking the presence of U.S. forces on the peninsula to any future peace agreement with North Korea. A Blue House presidential spokesman said the status of the 28,500 troops is part of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and has nothing to do with peace treaties. Meanwhile, South Korean Unification Minister Cho Myung-gyan said Wednesday that the recent inter-Korean summit was different from the previous two because of the possibilities of agreements reached actually being achieved. He said the process of improving relations and denuclearization is already underway. North Korea will be the central issue when President Moon Jae-in meets in Tokyo on May 9th with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and the Chinese Premier. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with RAND Corporation Japan researcher Jeffrey Hornung about that meeting.
It's expected that President Moon is going to brief Premiers Lee and Abe on his talk with Kim Jong-un. But at the same time, it's expected that they will talk trade, given that both China and Japan are at the brunt end of tariffs. It's also expected that there'll be some bilaterals here, and of importance to, that people are probably going to be watching is that between Moon and Abe and discussion of any historical issues between them.
Is World War II and the Japanese occupation of Korea behind those countries now?
It's not behind them by any stretch of the imagination. The history issues are still a very big issue between Japan and Korea. The history card can be played rather easily in South Korean politics. And issues like the comfort women is still a sticking point, even though the two countries agreed to get beyond the issue a few years ago. Some of the groups in South Korea were not happy with their government making that decision without their input.
How important would it be for Prime Minister Abe to meet with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un?
Well, it'd be important on a number of fronts. One, Prime Minister Abe has not had that direct channel with Kim that we see with Moon, President Xi, and President Trump in a couple weeks. And so being able to meet with Kim Jong-un would allow Prime Minister Abe to put Japanese interests on the table, including the abduction issue, alongside the denuclearization and missile issues. But at the same time, it would be symbolic in the sense that it would show that Japan is still a major player in the region and that, contrary to a lot of critics, that it's being cut out or left behind in all the regional diplomacy, it would show that Japan really is sitting at the table with the other countries.
President Trump indicated on Tuesday that a decision on the venue for his meeting with Kim Jong-un apparently will be made public in just a matter of days. How important is this meeting to these three countries?
This is really the main event. So if you look at the meeting between Moon and Kim as sort of the opening act, getting a lot of the issues on the table and sort of airing what we could expect, it's really going to be the Trump-Kim meeting that's going to really flesh out the agenda moving forward. And it's going to be important for President Trump and Kim Jong-un that China, South Korea, and Japan really are on the same page with some of these issues. Because if there is substantial disagreement, it's going to provide opportunity for North Korea to drive a wedge between some of these countries and sort of have the, like we've seen in the past, numerous times where issues get tabled and then disagreements happen between the countries and then really nothing moves forward.
Jeffrey Horning said if past history is any guide, nothing will come from the inter-Korean thaw. The only difference will be if North Korea makes what he called a commitment to real costly actions that are difficult to reverse, such as international inspections, nuclear plants decommissioned, and weapons dismantlement. May and June bring cyclones and floods to southeastern Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees who fled ethnic cleansing in Myanmar live in low-lying, crowded camps across the border. Aid groups warn of landslides, floods, and disease outbreaks. Jason Patinkin was at the camps and spoke to some refugees and aid workers frantically preparing for the oncoming storms.
Seasonal rains have begun at the refugee camps in southeastern Bangladesh, where some 700,000 Rohingya are living in squalid, overcrowded conditions. The Rohingya fled en masse from neighboring Myanmar last year, escaping violence the United Nations said was ethnic cleansing, an allegation denied by Myanmar. But now, stormy weather brings another challenge for the beleaguered Rohingya. The season's first small storms have already wrought destruction in the camps. Strong winds tore apart Rukia Begum's home during a nighttime squall.
The plastic sheet was ripped away and I took shelter in another house. In this small rain, I was not able to stay in my house. So when the heavy rains come, what will happen?
The winds are only the first weather problem. In June, monsoons usually hit Bangladesh and the camp is expected to flood. Heavy rains also increase risk of landslides on steep, unstable hillsides. Families are reinforcing the ground to save their homes, but multiple refugees have already died in small landslides. Over 100,000 people are at risk of floods and landslides, according to aid groups.
When we came from Myanmar, we didn't look if it was flat or hilly because we just needed shelter. Now with the rainy season, we are putting down sandbags, but they're falling down. The hill is collapsing.
Aid workers are handing out extra bamboo poles and plastic sheets to the refugees in hopes of strengthening their huts. Bangladeshi volunteers also teach the refugees how to build stronger shelters.
Our first priority is to give them a better shelter. We are increasing the quantity of materials than before. But we saw in recent wind and rain, the families who got our support did not have any damage.
But bamboo and tarps may not be enough to survive the biggest storms. The only real solution is for people to move to safer ground. On the western edge of the camps, where crews flatten hills to make space for families to relocate from hillsides and flood-prone areas.
We are about 2,250 workers working here. We have a lot of machines working for us. So our main focus is to save people from water and drowning and the landslide. Our main target is to bring the people before the monsoon comes.
But the new site can accommodate fewer than 20,000 people. That means tens of thousands of at-risk refugees have no option but to weather the coming storms. Jason Pitzingen for VOA News, Kutupalong Refugee Camp, Bangladesh.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks for staying with us for VOA Asia Weekend. Drill down further on many of our stories at voanews.com.